Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the 343 Podcast, where we work tirelessly to elevate the level of discourse and practitionership here in American soccer. Today with Benny, we are point blank aiming at the practitioners, at coaches specifically. We're going to be talking about constructing a session. Now, in the 343 premium program or other things out there online on the internet, you might see all these different activities, and some are better than others. But what's also quite important is the art of planning a session. What activity should you do on Monday? How about on Wednesday? How about on Thursday? How about before an actual match? Is it important who you are playing on the weekend? Is that going to dictate what your session looks like? Is it at the beginning of the season? Is it mid-season? Is it late in the season? What age are you coaching? And on and on and on with respect to session planning. What is it you should do? What does the flow look like, etc.? And if you're not a coach, I think this is important for you to listen into as well, because the more you know, the better parent you can be to your kid. The more you know, the better a media person you can be, because you can actually speak a little bit more informed from a position of being more informed, that is. And if you're a fan, let's say a fan of the U.S. men's national team, a fan of an MLS team, you know, it gives you a little bit of an insight from a practitioner's point of view if you start judging, say, the coach of the U.S. men's national team, Pochettino, or Greg Berhalter, or Jurgen Klinsmann, or whoever the next guy is. And if you're in the MLS scheme, is Trundolo really a good manager, yes or no? Well, it's hard to know if you're not there in the training session seeing what they're actually doing and why it is that they're doing what they're doing, but at least you're going to get some insight in this episode. So here we go, everybody, with session planning. Of course, coaches, you can go to 343coaching.com and get the program, a free program or the premium program that keys you into the pioneering work of Brian Kliban, who helped revolutionize youth soccer development here in the United States over the past 20 years. I won't go into all the details as to why that is a true statement. You might just be new around here and have to get to know us a lot better. For that, there are 300 written articles that I've published since 2009 and tens of thousands of X posts that you can go and take a look at. You can go to our YouTube channel, which is, by the way, where these episodes are also published. Oh, I should also mention, if you're not a coach and you're not helping sponsor the program by being educated through our products and services, just go to the YouTube channel and smash the like buttons on a whole bunch of our videos. Subscribe to the YouTube channel. All these little signals help us grow and in turn will help create a better soccer environment over the course of time. Parents, we have a product for you as well at 343masterclass.com. You are a crucial component to your player's development. So the more you know, the better off your kid will be. At 343masterclass.com, we have codified our decades worth of experience at every single age group, every single level, including the professional level. We have close to 10 years of actual practitioner work at the pro level as well. So we've seen countless cycles of players from U9 up to and including 30-year-olds. So we've seen what works, what doesn't work, what are the pitfalls, what should be emphasized at what ages, so on and so forth. So once more, coaches, go to 343coaching.com, get on that premium program as fast as you can, and parents, 343masterclass.com. Lastly, if you're coaching 7 versus 7, go to 7v7coaching.com. The promotion is still on. You can hop on board at half the price there of our regular pricing. All right, everybody, I hope you enjoy this episode on session planning with Benjamin Rogers. Here we go. Get us started right away, Benny. Launch us into it.
Yeah. All right, let's do it, man. I want to put on hold, first of all, U.S. soccer, national team, Club World Cup, you know, all that stuff's kind of over. I want to get back to what we're good at and what we love and what the people want. I want to talk today about designing an individual session plan. And this is within module 4 of the 343 coaching education platform. I want to really dive deep into it. And obviously, I know that having Brian on here would be huge. We can't have that right now, obviously. He's with his pro team now. But I think having you as somebody that was there in the trenches with him every single day, I think it will allow us to kind of pick his brain a little bit, you know, dive deep into what you saw and just kind of the process of how he went about it. You know, so I want to start from the early days Maybe we could start with Rage, OSC Rage, one of Brian's first club teams that he had. Back then, Gary, before the sessions, before going to training and practices, did Brian at that time already have a good idea of what his sessions would look like? Or was it, you know, how most young coaches that are just getting started, they're driving to training and they start thinking about what they want to do in their head? You know, because I know by the time that he got to TFA and Chivas Academy, by that time, he had detailed sessions planned out on the paper, ready to go. Was it like that in the early days, Gary? Or was it more of on the fly, this is what we're going to kind of do?
Yeah, thanks for the disclaimer aside, because obviously he's the one who designs the sessions and prepares everything going into it. I just assist. So in the early days, if I'm being correct here, you know, we're just making shit up. He's just making shit up. He's picking up things from what he saw in Marcelo Bielsa's training, for example, of Argentina. One particular thing that comes to mind, which is kind of professionalizing the sessions because they weren't like quote unquote professional in the beginning, was when he split the field in three sections or three zones. So if you're looking at the field lengthwise like this, from goal to goal, you know, you've got the two channels hugging the sidelines, right? That white might be, I don't know, 10 yards or something like that in width, or 5 yards in width or whatever. And then you got the broader middle section. Okay. And so he actually got some ribbons to actually partition the field that way. And I don't know, from our vantage point, obviously you have to talk to him. It's like, oh shit, we're getting serious now. You know, we're cutting up the field in sections. And obviously that is to facilitate a whole bunch of exercises. Maybe you want to restrict the wingers and the outside backs to remain in those channels to develop some sort of tactical positional discipline. Or maybe you want to design a session such that you want to complete as many passes into those channels successfully to your wingers or your outside backs. And that's how your team scores points. Like if you're playing like a scrimmage, let's say. So, but before that, I think he had been very consistent from the beginning up to and through, you know, the later years, where not once was there use of a session planner software or any such technology thing like that. Nah, it was kind of like going to a Starbucks maybe an hour or 30 minutes before arriving to the field or 45 and sitting down and on a little notepad like this, just scribbling down some chicken scratch. And this was one of my main complaints about him. He gets mad, right? You know how he gets mad when I criticize, right? But his writing is so small, Ben, that you need a magnifying glass to understand what the heck has been written down. They look like little ants on the paper. So imagine all these little ants all over the paper, and only he understands what the heck anything says. Or it's not clear. Oh, 4v1 rondo and this and that. It's like a disaster. The only thing that is partially recognizable is for each activity that is going to happen throughout the course of the session, he already has premeditated what players are going to be grouped together, right? So he already understands that sort of dynamic. But no, it was never a quote-unquote professional thing, Ben. It's kind of, I liken it more to like an artist's way of working versus a meticulous business plan, right? Where you got a suit and the suit goes and prepares a PowerPoint presentation, you know, and goes into a meeting all prepared with a nice, you know, typography and penmanship and no. Chicken scratch on a notepad and crumpled up and put into his side pocket or something. And then when the activity's about to end, he takes it out. He's like, okay, well, what's going on here? Okay, Cruz, Sebastian, Lo, you go over there. You know, that's it.
Yeah. No, I like watching the training sessions. Like even when he's at Chivas and he's about to finish an activity, he goes on to the next one, pulls out this folded piece of paper from his pocket, and you hear the paper wrestling in the microphone, and it's just funny, bro. So Gary, you mentioned, we'll dive deeper more into the complexities of his planning and everything like that. You mentioned an important topic, the fact of the matter where Brian would, before every session, he would plan which players are going to be where, whether it be like in the specific rondo or a possession team. Would he mix, or for example, would he have the best players be in a particular rondo, or would he kind of sprinkle it up to say, hey, these are two or three of my top guys. I'm going to put them with some of the lower players on the roster.
It depends, and it can vary from session to session, week to week, month to month, year to year. What does it depend on? I don't know. Like his feelings, our feelings as to what the current situation calls for. So
right.
most of the time, it was probably a mixture of players. Some of the time, it was the best players were grouped together, the mid-tier players were grouped together, and the worst players were grouped together. But that was usually not the case. Usually it was a mixture. And these are for activities where you can mix, obviously,
yes.
Because if you have like a positional rondo, or if you have some sort of tactical exercise, you can't be just mixing players positionally
right.
all over the place. I think when we wanted to really push a player, you have to be in with the best group, because that is when you see when you get exposed. So it might be a grouping of the five quote unquote best guys on the team, and we lump in somebody from the bottom 20% of the roster in there, and they get to feel right what the level is like, and they get to know or help them level up, sort of thing. So that's one of the benefits. And obviously it benefits the best player sometimes to go in with the C group at times, because it gives you a chance to maybe exercise some leadership skills, right? And
right.
you kind of tell the best player, hey, you're going over here, be the man, be the guy that is the mentor, be the coach yourself there, you know, encourage them, try to level them up. Because obviously if they get leveled up, the team gets leveled up, which levels you up as well. So, I mean, all that sort of conversation, as you can imagine, Benny.
Yeah, I've had it in the past, Gary, where, like, for example, 4v1 rondos, right? It was maybe a U9 team of boys. I would separate them into, okay, this is the A group. This is the best players on the team, the ones that can execute, a B, and then maybe a C, right? And then after about 2 weeks, I had a parent come up to me because their kid was in the C group, you know? And they're like, hey, like, why are you separating my kid from playing with these kids, right? And my reasoning is like, one, the top group, Gary, when you put those guys together, the rondo is just executed so much better, right? The weight of the passes, the first touch, they can actually string together 10, 15 passes in a row. Whereas if you throw a player from the C group in there, the rondo gets disrupted after two or three, right? But not only that, it's a level of competition where you can say, hey, listen, if you're not in this top group right now, you better be working your ass off to where you're going to get to this group. Or even for the guys that are in the A group, it's like, if you guys are dicking around, if you're not focused, if you're not completing your passes, you can, okay, easily you're going to go in and work with the other group. So I found, you know, a lot of benefit in that. And when I explained it to the parent, they're like, oh, actually, like, you know, that makes sense too. And even the C group, Gary, they have more success too, because the guy in the middle pressing is not a man child or not as much as a beast. And they're able to connect, you know, 5, 6, 7 passes in a row. So a lot of coaches, and not just in rondos, but in all of their activities, there's no specific plan before where, hey, I'm going to put these guys in this group to get this out of that. You know what I'm saying? So I think that's a big thing that people don't realize.
I actually agree with you. I think it is a good thing to do, is having the A, B, and C teams. Because, look, let me just share a couple of thoughts. Number one, if you put one of the best players with the B or the C team, for instance, a couple of things are happening. And both things are not to the benefit of the best player. Number one, he's in a shit environment or shittier environment. So that player is not getting better technically. The passes aren't right. The passes aren't crisp. The rondo falls apart, you know, really easily. And with that latter point, it demoralizes the best player, and it makes the best player not have fun and not have a good time. And we all know, we all like to say, you know, everybody out there, oh, it should be about fun and the kids should be having fun and all this stuff. Okay, well, when you put the best player, the best players in with the worst players, the best players are not having a good time. They're hating life. You know, it's not enjoyment for them. So you're actually harming player development for your best guys. The only one who ends up benefiting are the lower tier players, But then it you know, you go into coaching philosophy at this point, or philosophy in general. It's like, who do you want to target for player development? Because you cannot target everybody, Benny. I wrote a long article many, many years ago, which kind of goes over this, and maybe we can link it in the show notes. And it basically says, you know, if you target the low end of the group because you want to uplift them or something, well, then you're harming the mid-tier players and you're harming the best players the most, right? Because maybe you're doing the activities with, let's carry along with your 4v1 rondo. Maybe if you're targeting the lower tier players, you make the rondo size larger, right? So there's more space and time for the lower tier players. Well, if you do that, you're harming player development for the mid and the top tier players because they already mastered a larger grid. They need reduced space and time to get better. If you target the middle of the group, then, hey, cool, you're kind of helping the middle of the group, and you're also helping greatly the lower end of the roster because the lower end of the roster is being pushed harder to get better. But you're still screwing over the best players. You with me?
Right.
And if you target the best players in the group, well, I think that is honestly, sincerely the best approach because you're getting the best players and making them better. You're pushing the middle of the roster to get better, right? Kind of like survive or die, sink or swim. And the lower end of the roster, yeah, it might get extreme for you, might be very difficult for you. But at that point, I view it as like either you sack up and you start doing work outside of the team environment, like a mother effort, like we always advocate for, and try to catch up. Or at the end of the day, at the end of the season, the reality is maybe there's a better fit for you level-wise with another team, okay? And where you will get 90 minutes of playing time, where the training sessions will be more geared towards you. And I have received some feedback from that article. And whenever I talk about this, oh, well, Gary, well, why don't you mix it all up? You know, sometimes target the high end, sometimes the middle, sometimes the low end. And what you end up doing at that point is you satisfy nobody. You average everything out at that point. So you're basically doing average work for an average audience, and you're never going to be remarkable. And you're never going to be remarkable in player development. So you're just there for no reason at all.
Right. Gary, when you say target the top group, do you mean specifically designing the session plan for them? Or do you mean, and it could be both, do you mean like within the rondos, let's say there's three groups, your main focus and your main attention is on those guys? Like maybe you walk over to the other rondo and the lower one, but your main focus and coaching points and most of your energy is going to the top group. Is that what you say when you say target?
That's a good point. And that's not really necessarily what I'm saying. I'm not saying neglect the other guys from a coaching perspective at all. You absolutely are paying attention to the mid and to the lower tier, and you might be spending more time with those guys and trying to give them more coaching points and try to help them more. But the activities themselves are designed and structured for the best.
Yeah,
like for sure. Because everybody's familiar with the 4v1 rondo. So to keep with that line of thinking, you make the 4v rondo grid size the size for the best players.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. No, and by doing that and designing it for that top core group of players, you're almost forcing the mid group and the bottom group to catch up, because otherwise they're going to get left behind. And Gary, that's when, you know, feelings start getting hurt and you start having these individual conversations with the parents and say, look, I mean, your kid can't keep up in the 4v1. He's trying to execute, but there needs to be a massive amount of work off the field in order for him to be able to keep up with this group, you know? And that's why I think sometimes it is best for, and I know the haters in the comments are going to say, oh, you guys are talking about cutting a 10-year-old player or a 9-year-old player. Well, listen, some teams are very high level, and the fact of the matter is that some kids can't hang on those teams, and it's better for their development to go and find a team where they're going to play 80 minutes in the game versus 20 minutes or 30 minutes, or you know what I mean?
Yeah. And the parent problems go both ways. So you just illustrated the parent problems coming from the lower end of the roster, right?
Right.
Complaining stuff. But if you start doing sessions where you're targeting the lower end of the roster, the middle end of the roster, and mixing players up, and the best players aren't with the best players, you're doing all this other stuff. Well, guess what? The parents of the best players on the team are going to come at you with problems and say, hey, Gary, like, what the fuck? Why'd you put, you know, my son with the C squad, you know, it's clear that, you know, it's not helping my kid develop at all if he's with the worst players on the team, and it never ends. So you have, as a coach, yes, you do your best to manage everybody and try to satisfy the needs of everybody as best you can. But at the end of the day, in my opinion, you have to be biased towards the higher end.
Yeah, because think about it. I mean, would you rather have the top players on your team? Would you rather have those parents coming up to you and saying, hey, what's going on? Or the bottom ones? Because when the bottom ones come up to you, Gary, and they say, oh, this is messed up, I'm going to leave the team. It's like, okay, fantastic, you know, but...
And it's probably best.
Yeah, probably best. But if it's the other end, it's like, you know, whoa, let's take a step back here. And no, I agree, dude. So
if it's the other end, it's team destruction. And guess what? Guess who gets hurt? Everybody on the team gets hurt.
Yeah,
so if two of the best guys leave, well, the other guys who were also part of the group of the best players, their development gets harmed. The mid-tier gets harmed because the team is worse off. And the lower end gets harmed because the team is worse off.
Right. Yeah.
So it's just another asymmetry there that exists as to why it is advisable to coach to the high end.
Exactly. Well, so Gary, you said that in the early days, it was kind of just making stuff up. What would those rage sessions look like? You know, was it just a couple rondos here and there and set up a grid and you play 10v10 and battle it out, stop it every once in a while on coaching points? Or what did those sessions look like?
You're killing me here because you're talking 20 years ago, but it was basically, okay, so circle keep away, what everybody in the United States thought was a rondo back then, you know, which is the classic circle keep away. You put like, I don't know, five, six, seven, eight, 10 guys in a circle, depending on how many you have on the perimeter, you throw in one or two in there to run like crazy. So you do that, you know, for 10 minutes at the beginning of the session, 12 minutes, however long. Maybe you do two groups and you're doing that sort of stuff. And then, God, maybe there's like a small-sided game that would be played with some sort of objective in mind with pug goals or something like that. Don't even ask me what the heck we were doing, Benny. I can't tell you.
Yeah.
Then maybe it was some sort of tactical thing. Like Brian was already inventing or working on building out of the back. Like how are we going to do this? Because there was no information, Benny, okay? So some sort of activity, I think swinging the ball side to side with the back four and the keeper, that was a pretty simple thing to discover, invent, or having seen it once, you know, during a BSA session or something is sufficient for you to be like, oh, okay, I can just kind of do this. But maybe the details weren't all there, right? In that simple building out of the back with the back five or with the D mid. The details such as, hey, if the ball is facing you, you know, how you backpedal and how you spread out and create space. If, you know what I mean? Like if a left center back is pivoting to the right, then how the right back should kind of read that ahead of time and get all the way to the sideline, like all the tiny little things, or how separated the players should be, probably wasn't there either. Or how maybe not to skip a pass wasn't there. So for instance, what I mean by that, if you have the left back has the ball, the next pass is either to, sorry, the left center back has the ball. The next pass is either to the left back or to the right center back. You do not give it all the way to the right back. That's what I call skipping, right? A player.
Right.
So maybe that sort of detail was allowed to go by if one of the guys decided, oh, I'm just going to switch it completely and bypass the guy next to me. So we're just making shit up. And then is a scrimmage then. So that was the session. I mean, I think it's better, or maybe some fitness work thrown in there too. Absolutely. Because John Esham, our great friend, amazing friend, who was a specialist in these sorts of things, he would run people into the ground when it needed to happen. And that was all part of the culture.
Yeah. Oh, dude, I'll never forget when my brother Danny, his first session with the team. And I think we dropped him off and, you know, I came back towards the later stage. But when I got back, it was John Esham running like a mean ass fitness session. The guys were like carrying each other on their backs during hill sprints, and it was just wild, bro.
It was wild. It was, but it wasn't like he was completely making it up, in my opinion, because he was an athlete growing up. He was on covers of magazines as a wrestler. You know, I think he was a college wrestler as well. So obviously I think he was doing what he learned during his athlete years. So it wasn't a complete concoction. Oh, let's have these guys, just jump on each other's back and play chicken or something.
Yeah, no, wasn't he an Ironman, or he ran like 5 Ironman races or something like that?
Legend. I think you're right. I think you're right, man.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the early stages, Gary, the circle keep away was kind of thought to be and considered as a rondo. At what point did the rondos come in, like non-negotiable? Every session we're doing a 4v1 or 3v1.
I think Brian picked up a lot when he did his like internships at FC Barcelona.
Yeah.
And he would go there every single year for a couple weeks, a few weeks, access to La Masia, access to the B team. When Luis Enrique was the B team coach, I believe my memory serves me right. And so obviously at that point, and we're talking still like 15 years ago, whenever that was, we can look it up. That is where you really got down to the details. Like, here's a 4v1. Here's what it looks like. Here is what it works on. Here's why you absolutely do a two-touch mandatory for every player. Okay. You do not allow them to do one touch. It is a two-touch mandatory, and it's for A reason, B reason, C reason, D reason. You know, directly from them, Benny.
Right.
Do you want to do one touch at some point? Sure. But this is all the stuff that you're giving up. There's pros and cons to doing that. And the one touch, like 4v1, is supposed to come much later in development, okay? Because the two touch works on fundamentals. The one touch works on something else. And then all the positional stuff too. So I don't know how many rondos he got out of that, Benny. Maybe it was like 3, 4, 5, 7, 10 detailed, distinct rondos. And then once you start incorporating those things, as we've said so many times here, you as a coach don't actually know or understand what you're doing until years later, and you don't get the subtleties until years later of doing it religiously, and you don't become an amazing practitioner at each one of those until years later. I know you might think that, oh, I put the cones here. I have 5 players. These are the coaching points. This is what they're supposed to be working on. I know that in theory, that's easy to kind of grasp, but in practice and really, really sensing it, you don't get it for years, Benny.
Yeah, for sure. No, dude, at this point, I've been doing rondos as a coach, 8 or 9 years, and I'm still learning different little intricacies and coaching points. So, you know, people think that. And here's the other thing, Gary, people will say like, oh yeah, like my team does rondos, but maybe they've done it 5 times in their season and then they move on to something completely different and forget about it. You know, you need your players doing it every week, day in, day out. And I don't know how some coaches can't see the improvement and how fast the kids develop and when it comes to rondos. And you can see how it translates into the game. I mean, you have kids receiving across their body without even thinking about it, shifting into the right spaces. Their first touch in tight spaces increases massively. So there's just so many benefits to it, Gary. But so in the later years, obviously Brian started to get a little bit more organized, kind of had a framework for all the sessions. And this is, you know, now what 343 recommends is a warm-up technical exercise, tactical exercise, and then play, right? So to start with, Gary, when coaches hear the phrase warm up, I think a lot of them think like, okay, 5 minutes of stretching and then I'm going to set up a line of cones and have my team dribble through and let's work on some ball work, some ball mastery. Why do you recommend against that, Gary?
So warm up, we view as more informal sort of thing. And, you know, we do want the guys to take it seriously, but we also want to maximize fun. So it's not, basically we haven't entered super serious mode quite yet. Okay. So it's a circle keep away. for instance. So guys have fun, you know, clowning on each other, having a good time, laughing, etc. But don't let it get completely out of control. Like, let's do the actual activity well. Some stretching, obviously, you want to incorporate a little bit of stretching into it. Whatever they call it, static or dynamic stretching, that sort of stuff. Maybe you do incorporate a little bit of juggling work, but it's kind of structured juggling. I'll give you an example. So for instance, the whole group is supposed to start juggling at the same time, and they're all kind of confined to a specific grid of their own, right? They're not supposed to move outside the boundaries of, I don't know, a 2-yard by 2-yard sort of box, okay? And we tell them exactly the restriction. Okay, you're supposed to go left foot, right foot, left foot, right foot, left foot, right foot. And you just do that for a bit. And then you're like, right foot only. And then you go left foot only. And then you go thighs only. And then you give them heads only. And then you maybe do a more complicated pattern, right? Hey, you're supposed to go right foot, thigh, head, thigh, right foot, you know, that sort of thing. Obviously, it can get as advanced as you want, depending on the level of your player, because people in our audience might have 10-year-olds who can't even juggle 3 times in a row. Okay, so that's a little bit different, but that's kind of like a warm-up sort of thing involved, Ben. So you warm up, and then from there, you move into, say, the 4v1 rondo.
Right. So, yeah, because I'm glad that you said that, because I don't want people to think like the circle keep away is the rondo of the session. You know, that's just...
No.
Yeah. And I like that. Because, dude, you see, anytime you see a pro team, Gary, like when they release their full sessions on YouTube, whether it be Barca, Madrid, PSG, Chelsea, Liverpool, I mean, what's the first thing that you see all the guys doing when they show up to the field? Circle keep away. Obviously, at those levels, it's insane how those circles look, because the ball is just getting pinged 100 miles an hour with the cleanest first touch, and these guys are punking on each other. But I think it's a good way to get everybody engaged, get everybody kind of laughing, right? And then once that's over, it's like, all right, we flip the switch and we start going, you know. So really warm quick, up, Gary. Yeah, go for it.
Really quick on the juggling thing. I mean, that wasn't always done, Benny.
Right.
But, you know, when that was done, and for coaches out there to consider, I think juggling also adds a huge benefit of getting the players concentrated, okay? Because if you're doing, like, say, a circle keep away or something like that, your mind can drift and you're laughing, have a good time. But to actually juggle, you actually have to focus. So it shifts your mind into that zone of focus. And then after you're finished with the juggling activity, you're now primed and ready for the serious stuff.
Right. Now, I notice sometimes too, Gary, that in the sessions, like specifically I'm talking the Chivas era, when after the circle keep away rondo, sometimes Brian would send the group to like the fitness coach or Andrew May, and it wouldn't always be juggling. Sometimes it would be like dribbling outside of the foot, inside of the foot, or some type of fitness, you could say, with the ball. You know, so it wasn't always circle keep away, juggling, let's hop into the rondos, right? There's so many different things that you can incorporate in terms of the warm-up, right? So after the warm-up, you move into a technical exercise, right? Majority of the times it was 4v1, but what else besides rondos could you categorize as a technical exercise? Because again, coaches will hear technical exercise and think that lining up 7 cones in a row and dribbling through is a great way for their players to develop and get better on the ball.
Yeah. Almost never were there dribbling through cones. No, yeah. Almost never, Benny. Yeah. If anything, it's in the warm-up that you just described.
Right.
The kind of like the unserious, informal sort of piece of the session is like dribbling through cone things. But aside from rondos, I mean, there's a variety of things you can do. Usually they're passing exercises. So maybe like a short, long. And I know coaches understand what I mean by that, right? So it's like you got 3 guys, you know, and they're separated a certain distance apart, and you can dictate how far apart you want the whole line of 3 guys to be. And the first 2 passes are like short passes. So let's say of the line of 3, one of the guys at the very end has the ball. And then they pass it to the guy who's maybe checking in the middle. And it's a one-touch pass back to the guy who served them. And then maybe it's a one-touch long pass to the guy on the other end of the far side, right? And then the guy, and that guy who just did that long pass sprints or goes towards where he passed the ball. And it's a short, short pass again in the long and short, short, long. So there's something like that. You can also orient those same three guys in kind of like a V shape, and you work on passing, you know, receiving across the body, you know, so the guy in the middle is really working on getting a pass from the right, receiving it with the left, passing it with the right again to his buddy on the left side, and his buddy on the left side serves it back into him, and he does the same thing, goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. So you get a whole bunch of those sorts of repetitions. So I don't know, Ben, you can structure all kinds of sort of passing exercises, I think is what it would typically be if we weren't doing a rondo.
Yeah. Would you consider passing patterns, not like going to goal? I'm not talking about attacking patterns. The team is in their shape, but maybe like a square or diamond passing pattern. Would those ever happen within the sessions?
Oh, yeah, sure.
I was going to say a lot of what you see on Twitter is like, oh, look at this. Look at this,
yeah.
Pep Guardiola passing pattern from Man City, you know? I mean,
yeah.
And people see that and they're like, oh, wow, this is what they're doing. I'm going to add this into my sessions.
I mean, so sometimes, Ben, sometimes later in the 3-4-3 program, when the players kind of level up and have a certain level of technical competence, we would have them move into what are called básicos. Okay, so they're passing patterns like you just described. So there's a variety of arrangements, right? To arrange all the players on your team, and you're doing all these pinging of the ball back and forth in a preordained sort of way, right? With a certain objective, like maybe the objective is to rifle balls in, you know, and the guy who's going to receive the rifle ball is supposed to kind of deft touch pass, you know, to his other guy. So I don't know, Benny, I know what you're talking about. Maybe you can inject a little video of what you're talking about, but it's what you're saying. It seems completely like a random pattern passing exercise. Yeah, we would do that once in a while, but only when the players were leveled up, Benny.
Right.
Now, you don't do that sort of stuff, in my opinion, when you got players who don't even have a solid foundation yet.
100%. No, I
see. Is that what you were referring to?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I was referring to. And I think you bring up a good point about the level of your team and their ability to execute it, because I see a lot of youth teams that have no business doing those types of passing patterns, and their first touch is shocking and it gets disrupted within the third pass. So at those ages, I mean, stick to the basics, man. Stick to the rondos. Let them get comfortable with their feet, with the weight of the passes, their first touch. Because otherwise, it's just kind of just wasting time. You're really not getting anything out of it. You know, I can see when you get to the higher levels, yeah, it's good. Have variety and change up the way that you pass and your movement off the ball. But I think at the younger ages, it's just kind of just time wasting, dude. You know, for the parents, it looks so cool. Oh my gosh, they have poles out there. They have mannequins. They have all this cool setup, and look at those giant cones, and it's so colorful. This coach really knows what he's doing out there. And then you see the kids execute the pattern, and it's like, oh my gosh, what are we doing?
It is a waste of time. It truly is. And the reality is, like, even Brian's teams, when they got really good technically, and I'm talking maybe like the U14 age group or something like that, where they had... They were already the best in the country for 3 years running, destroying everybody, national champions left and right, playing FC Barcelona in Barcelona and taking them down to the wire and outpossessing them in big swaths of the game. Like that's the level that I'm talking about. And then like they're U14 and we throw them into one of these passing pattern or básicos, it's still a little shaky. It's still a little shaky, Benny. Yeah. It's still a little shaky. Like you'll see, you know, Real Madrid or Chelsea or something doing these sorts of básicos or national teams and stuff. And you see it like, oh yeah, that's cool. That it looks simple enough. It's a pass there and it's a pass here. And this guy does an outside, you know, go around the pole here and you do the little 1-2 and you're out. Simple enough. Look at what I'm telling you. I'm telling you, we had U14s among the best in the world, okay, basically. And it's kind of, ooh, touch and go, you know, because sometimes the pattern would break down and, you know, the ball would go outside the grid and you ruin the whole pattern. So, yeah, coaches out there, chill, work on the basics, work on the core, build the team up from the bottom up. And later on, if you want to layer in some more complexity, do it. But if you start doing this stuff in the beginning, you said it, Benny, best. It's a waste of time, and it's more kind of showmanship, I guess. I don't know, for the parents. And I know you have a lot of experience with the parents, Ben, because like if you do too much of the same thing, you're going to get questions. Like, oh, Benny, like we've been doing 4v1 Rondo for 3 months now. What's going on, man? There's more to soccer than just this.
For sure, dude. I've fielded off that question many times. But Gary, I don't know with Chivas, were they training 4 days a week or 3 days a week? Because my question is this, like on Monday, right? The objective for the game on the weekend is, okay, we want to build out of the back. That's our topic for the week. Would Brian run the same session twice in 1 week? Meaning that, okay, they worked on, you know, 4v1 rondos, building out of the back, a tactical game. Would he do it Monday and then do it again on Wednesday if the players hadn't fully grasped it, like the same exact session? Because I see a lot of coaches that do that where it's, okay, this is my session on Monday. I'm going to run the same exact thing on Wednesday so I can keep hammering these points home. Or would he mix it up and bring in variety?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not exactly sure. I know it did happen. I just don't know if it would always happen, Benny. Right. I think it would happen once in a while. I think a lot of it did depend on what he judged were the necessities of the team in that moment. It's like, fuck, like these guys seriously cannot build. They just don't get it, you know, or build a specific way. They just don't get it. And after doing it for a session, if it's not to one's liking and it's like they still don't get it, then you're going to do it again. So right. I think it, a lot depended on that. And perhaps the opponent on the weekend as well. It's like, hey, we want to play this specific way on the weekend. So you just hammer it home. What you don't do is mix a couple things or a few things throughout the week that are completely unrelated. Okay. I don't think you do that. And with respect to prepping for a game, I know set pieces are very important. And there was always a set piece walkthrough, perhaps on the last session leading up to a match.
Yeah. Because would they train 3 days a week with Chivas or was it four?
I can't remember either. I think it was three, Benny. I think it was three. Sometimes maybe there was a four, but three a week, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. And that's the tough part because he did have more time with the team. I feel like, I don't know, Gary, I'm just making this up. 75% or 80% of coaches and teams, they only had the luxury of field space for training 2 days a week, you know, so they're trying to, and not even a 2 hour session. Maybe they have an hour and 15 minutes or an hour and 30. So they're trying to cram in as much as they can. So I think if you can find a way to train 3 days a week, amazing. Because then even on the third day, Gary, if you want to do some more of the technical work and not so much as tactical, then okay, fantastic. You have more time. But if you're fitting that stuff in within 2 days and trying to cram in 20 different exercises on Monday and Wednesday, it's just the players aren't going to grasp what you're trying to do. You know, you got to keep it simple.
Yeah, something that's it's related and hugely underrated is the value of having an assistant.
Yeah.
And if you can have two, even better, obviously, but that's a luxury at this point. Even having one assistant is a luxury for obvious reasons.
Yeah, for sure. So Gary, we talked about the warm-up, the technical exercise. Moving on to the tactical exercise, you know, let's just stick with building out of the back because that's kind of what we've been talking about. When it comes to building out of the back, obviously, the main focus or the core players that you're using is the back line, the six, you know, maybe the eight, maybe the 10. Would there be instances where you kind of separate the groups and you say, all right, I'm taking, because Brian did have the luxury of having assistants, right? So would he say, hey, I'm taking these 7, 8, 9 guys. The rest of you are going to work on this finishing activity, or are you going to be with the assistant coach?
All the time. That's actually why I wanted to bring up the idea of assistance, is so that you can actually do that. Because there's different phases of the game, right? There's the offensive phase, and there's the defensive or the build out phase. If we're talking about in possession, you got to split it up somehow, some way. If you want to maximize repetitions, and you want to maximize focus, and you want to maximize the coach's ability to give tailored instructions, it's like a classroom size, right? If you're teaching a class, if you've got 100 students at the end of the semester, you don't know everybody's name even. Okay. Yeah, everybody's just a number. And if you have 10 students, obviously you're going to get to know everybody on a name to name basis. So separating is huge. It would always happen, Benny, almost always in all sessions. It's like, hey, we're going to do this positional rondo over here, and Gary, go and work on finishing with the strikers or something like that. I'm going to work on building out of the back. Andrew May, go do the offensive pattern choreography with the wingers, the 10 and the outside back, or whatever the case may be. Always happening, Benny, that.
Yeah.
Your point about most in the American soccer ecosystem don't have the luxury of field space or number of days per week for coaching. I would say that at the higher levels, you kind of do need all the space to work with, right? Because to actually improve the players and a team that's already really good, to improve them more, you need more infrastructure. You understand what I'm saying? And more things like field space and days. The lower level you are, you don't need all this infrastructure really to it really make a great impact in improving your players and improving your team. So if we're talking about U10 or U11 or even U12 or something like that, it's fine if you have maybe only a quarter of a field, because at those ages, the thing that's going to improve them the most are the small little rondos. Okay. And you want to build out of the back? Cool. You don't need a full width field or something like that to build out of the back. No. I think for the most part, if you could get a quarter or something like that, you can get the principle across and you can have them go through the exercise. So you don't need resources at the lower levels, I guess is what I'm saying. And you may not have to do the splitting up of the defenders with me and the attacking guys with you or with their assistant. You know, you probably don't have to do that.
Yeah, I think you can get away with it, Gary, but I think at the young ages, if you can find or you have access to a full field and you can work on building out of the in my career with, I don't know, I've had 5-6 U teams. I had one team where every session I had access to a full field, and that team was just significantly better at building out spacing, attacking patterns, because you can try and show the other teams on your small little quarter of a field, all right, here's the movements. But then once they get onto the regular size field, it's like, coach, what am I supposed to do? I have no idea, you know? So
I agree with you 100%, Ben. It's just people want me to be positive. They want me to be positive. So I'm like, hey, if you got a little corner of field, like it's cool, you know, you can still make a huge impact.
Yeah, for sure. Not somebody put, Gary, you mad, bro?
I'm smiling all the time. I'm laughing all the time. Dude. I don't know why people think I'm mad.
We should raffle off a 1-hour lunch with Gary Klaben, bro.
The fuck? I charge $1,000 an hour, bro. That's like a $1,000 giveaway.
Hey, for the fans, bro, do anything.
No. Like, I've done things like that in the past where when I'm traveling, you know, I'll just shoot out a message to everybody. Hey, I'm going to be in this city or that city if you want to link up or something like that. So I have done that. I don't know. Just, you know me, Ben. Just nowadays, my days are so jam-packed. Yeah. It's hard for me to be present with people because my mind is always on the fires that are currently burning, and I have to do something about the fires that are currently burning or the things that are on my to-do list. So I don't know. I thought I'd just share that little tidbit. I used to do it a lot and meet up with random coaches, random people in random cities all the time. And I just haven't done that in years.
Yeah. All right, Gary, would you say the tactical exercise, would the most amount of time be spent during this phase, on this phase of building out or attacking patterns, or was it all kind of evenly distributed? And by the way, I want to bring up the point of, you know, Brian did such an amazing job of establishing the tone and establishing the theme of the session in that first, you know, warm up or whatever it was. And, you know, there's a video of him actually, I think they were in the rondos. And then he starts to say, hey, when we move into this next phase, you know, I want to see specifically this. So I think he did a really good job of kind of preparing the players for what was to come next and helping them recognize all of the things that he wanted them to grasp from each individual activity, you know? So I think that's important too. My initial question was, would you spend the most time on the tactical exercise?
It's hard to say, Benny. It's really hard to say, dude. I mean, if I have to say something, I would say evenly distributed between building out and the attacking phase. The other thing that comes to mind is, you know, there's different ways of training building out. There's different scenarios that you can train your team on. And so you also have to judge a level of boredom at times, because the rondos, for instance, are very fast paced, high repetition activities. And as a consequence of that, there's a high level of enjoyment for the players. The tactical stuff is less enjoyable for the players, because a lot of it is, hey, we're teaching you how to play chess, basically. Okay.
Right.
And the only difference between chess and this is that you are actually a player, and you have to actually execute, you know, a movement, or actually have to execute kicking a ball, but you don't get that many reps. So what am I talking about? I'm talking about, let's say you do the classic, I'm keeping it simple for the audience, the classic building out with the four in the back, the goalkeeper, and the six, okay? If you're the outside back, put yourself in their shoes. Like, how many times are you touching the ball on this activity? Not very often. It'll come around once in a while and stuff. And the rest of the time you're observing and you're making your movements the way you're supposed. So it's kind of boring. And especially once the players really get it and are really good at it, you don't want to keep doing that thing every session and for years and for 15 minutes every session. Like, that is a disaster at that point. So you move on to a different type of building out, and then a different type of building out, and then a different type of building out. And for the most part, I would say the offensive pattern choreography is a lot more exciting, a lot more fun, because then there's also a finishing component to it all. And then you can keep score at that point as well. So I don't know, Ben, I'm going to say evenly distributed, but for the teams that are very early in their development and don't have a clue or don't even know or don't successfully build out during competitive matches, you bias it more towards focusing on that and not the offensive patterns, because you need a build out, Benny. That is the foundation of everything.
Yeah.
So in the beginning, heavily biased towards that. Later, not so much in the build out.
Yeah. Yeah. I think maybe you misunderstood my exact question, but a lot of great points, but I'm saying within each individual session. So there's four phases, right? Warm up, technical, tactical, play. Was the most time spent on the tactical phase in those session?
No. Yeah. And the tactical is not the most at all. So I would say warm up, maybe 10, 15 ish minutes. The rondos, which is the technical sort of stuff, another 15, 20-ish minutes. The tactical, maybe 10, 15 minutes, and then you play at the end. You know, so the tactical is maybe 15 minutes out of an entire session, or 20 minutes out of an entire session. So it's a minority.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. So moving on to the last phase, Gary, play. All right, some coaches will hear that and think, all right, cool. You know, my job's done. Let me just set up two goals. Let me just let the kids play. And the common phrase that everybody loves in America, let them play and let them figure it out, you know. But how was Brian's version of play different from what everybody thinks play should be?
Okay. First, let me put a disclaimer out there. I think let the kids play, and in the context of a scrimmage, generally speaking, for the most everybody in the country, that might be a good idea, because most players don't get the pickup soccer culture at all. So maybe it is a good idea, you know, for you're coaching U11 in Nebraska or something like that, and nobody in Nebraska is playing pickup soccer, and your particular team demographic is of that nature. Maybe when you do the scrimmage, you just let them play. I don't know. Just have them have that sort of experience. Brian, at times, would do that too. Okay. But most of the time, I got to be careful here. I don't know what the time distribution was, but let's say many a times, there are certain objectives, parameters, restrictions in the play section. For instance, maybe it is a two-touch sort of scrimmage, two-touch maximum. You can play one touch. You can only have two-touch max, or maybe even three. Three touches is your max, okay? And you switch it up depending on how chaotic everything is. If people are holding onto the ball for the full three touches every time when it was clear that the right decision was a one-touch pass, right? It should have been a 1-2 or something like that, and the guy's taking three touches. It's like, no, no, no. And this is not good. You're learning the wrong things. You have bad behaviors or bad habits. One touch for everybody. Or you mix it up. Maybe you have neutrals, and those are the only guys with one touch restrictions, you know, and everybody else has unlimited touches. So it depends, again, on the objectives that one wants to accomplish, Ben. That's all.
Right. And I'm sure, like, let's say the theme of the day was losing your man. Like, I guarantee you Brian's going to be, you know, not every play, but, you know, making sure that the players are grasping what it is that they just worked on. Or maybe he's spotlighting one player, and as it's a left winger, and when the ball's with the left center back, he's, you know, he's yelling at him, hey, you know, start reading the play, start losing your man. So ensuring that whatever it is that you covered in the session gets brought up, you know. And I think
go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think this is in phase one, maybe it's in phase two, but it's a 10v10 tactical game where the field is, you know, separated into three zones, and the ball must enter every single zone before you can go forward. I think that one is massive, you know, because it starts the players to get this idea in their head of, hey, you don't always have to go forward. You don't always have to drive, you know, let's switch the point of attack. Let's draw them in. And then when the time is ready, boom, we're going to go and execute. You know, that one to me is my favorite tactical game that is within the course.
No, that it's awesome, man. That's exactly right. And you can add on a different layer. You can add on losing your man there, because now it's not a pug goal that you want to score on at the other end. The other end, instead of a pug goal, it's your like winger, your number nine or something like that in a strip, you know, that is at the end of the field. And he's being man marked, right? Or marked by another player. And so the objective is, when your team has the ball and you went through the three zones like you described, and now we're going to go forward and try to score, the way you score is you have to connect that final pass with your teammate over there. And that teammate over there, the only way they're going to be able to receive the pass is if they lose their man. So you have to like kind of juke them one way, right? Check one way and go the other way. And the team, your teammate in possession, has to recognize, okay, he's doing the movement. He wants the ball there now. And all in anticipation. So you're working that sort of muscle memory also.
Yeah, for sure. I have two more things for you, Gary. One, I know you mentioned Brian's famous miniature writing on this piece of paper. What, besides what he was actually going to do, and like, for example, he wrote Rondo, build out of the back, you know, attacking pattern play, what specific details would he write on the paper? Meaning like, hey, these are, do you know? Did you ever see the papers?
Ben, I just told you it's illegible. So at some point, I'm not looking at that shit anymore. Zero.
Right.
So the only kind of thing I would get is just verbal, right? It's like, okay, or before the training session even starts, okay, Gary, like, look, we're gonna do this and this and this and we what, and then you get those guys over there, you know, blah blah blah, and that would be it. That's all. Or he might be like, hey, do you think we should put, you know, Jose in this group or in this group or something like that? Because I don't know, for X, Y, or Z reasons. And he wanted a different opinion, right, as to what to do. But I wasn't there with his notepad looking at that nonsense. There was nobody can read. You know how they say doctors have chicken scratch, can't read doctor's notes, it's a disaster? Yeah. Bro, this was probably worse.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to ask Brian to send me one of his old sessions, bro.
That would be cool, man.
see if I can decipher it, bro. Scan it.
Well, I wonder what he's doing now, right? I wonder if his assistants there at AVAlt or something is using some software technology to actually put everything cleanly or...
I would be curious, dude. And it's funny, too, because like I haven't taken a U.S. soccer course in 3 years, maybe. But when you take those courses, Gary, they are so like specific on, hey, you need to use this software. You need to have this exact dimension. You need to make sure that your little players are this avatar right here. The ball size needs to be this one. And bro, you end up spending more time just trying to figure out that software than actually thinking about your own session. You know, so I think the old school way, bro, pen and paper, you knock it out in 10, 15 minutes, a golden session right there, bro. But when you're spending all this little time, like, oh, I need to find this avatar and I need to make sure I use this color line. It's like, dude, you're just wasting your time, really. I don't know. Some people may disagree and say like, oh, no, you need to be more organized. That's not how they do it at the pro level. But I don't know. I have a feeling Brian probably still writes his stuff on a paper and maybe tells the staff like, hey, you know, let's get this printed or something like that. I don't know. I'd be curious to know.
Yeah, this is a whole huge topic, and not just soccer specific topic, just a general topic for any profession. I have some opinions on it. Number one is I think for new practitioners in particular, I think getting organized is very important. Very, very important, because at least it gives you some sort of structure, and having that organization gives you a certain amount of confidence going into a session, because you already, there's nothing unpredictable. Let's put it to you that way. So it helps with that. And if everybody sees that you're organized and you've got like these beautiful diagrams, or you've got a nice notebook, you know, hardbound notebook that you're opening up, and the players see that and the parents see that, it kind of gives your audience confidence that you're good. You know what you're doing. You're organized, you're disciplined, those sorts of things. So for new coaches and experienced coaches, I think it's very important. I think over the course of time, if you become, I don't know, very good at the craft, extremely good at the craft, have great expertise in the craft. If we want to use the word mastery, we can use the word mastery. I think a practitioner sometimes transitions away from that, because they're such masters at their craft that they don't need all of that stuff anymore. They don't need those guardrails anymore. It's all here in the head already. So they can just go out there and wing an entire thing out of thin air and on the fly and in real time. I know it to be true too, because, you know, what I've been trained in physics and mathematics and in engineering, I know I keep coming back to that, but there's so many parallels, Benny, because it's teaching. The masters, they aren't teaching with fucking notes, okay? They're just going up to the front of the room, whoever their audience happens to be. It could be an audience of colleagues, or it can be an audience of students. And they're like, okay, what do we want to talk about today? Oh, and somebody says, I want to talk about, you know, entanglement in quantum mechanics. Oh, okay, cool. And off you go, off the professor goes, you know what I'm saying? Like, because you know your shit. But when you're first starting out, you're incapable of doing that. I just thought I'd throw that out there. And from Brian's particular perspective, or my perspective of Brian, I think he is of that latter group where you don't have to have things on your software. And, oh, the triangles are your offensive players and the circles are your defensive players. And this guy's going to pass it there, so it's a dotted line with an arrow. And this guy's going to make this run, so it's a solid line, you know, with an arrow this way, and it has to be red. And fuck all that. Get the fuck out of my face with that. That shit is all nonsense.
Yeah. I think a lot of people will agree with that. But I want to end with this, Gary. And I know we brought it up many times on this show, but I want to, you know, keep hammering down, especially I know we have a lot of new listeners. You know, what is, in your opinion, the biggest mistake that coaches make when planning individual sessions, or even planning an entire month of sessions? What's the biggest mistake that they're making?
Thanks for the softball, man. It's obvious and it's clear as day. You do too much.
Yeah.
Doing too much is the number one mistake everybody makes. If you're doing If you're going from activity to activity to activity and it's always kind of different, that is the worst possible thing you can do for your players. That is the worst possible thing you can do for your team. That is the worst possible thing that you can do to yourself as a coach, because nobody learns anything. The best thing that you can do is do the same bloody thing over and 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 over again. That's the best thing to do for your players, for your team, for yourself. The challenge, Benny, is what are those activities, those small set of activities that you should be doing over and over and over again? That is the magic, is in knowing which one of those things you should be doing and which one of those things you should not be doing.
Yeah. Now, dude, I wish there was a website that told you all these different activities that you can do, bro.
343coaching.com, brother. Thanks for the softball. I really appreciate it, man. I rarely get softballs here. You're telling me, you know, comments that are left on the YouTube channel saying, Gary, you don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Or you're telling me about comments that are on the Instagram thing, which I don't even go to, you know, most of the time, but I hear there's a lot of activity there. And yeah, half the comments are like, hey, I appreciate your work, doing awesome. And the other half is like, who is this bozo? And you're a moron if you think Pochettino knows what he's talking about. Okay, man.
Insane, bro. Hey, bro, we've kind of went away from this. We haven't done it in the last couple episodes, but you know, how does promotion relegation tie into creating an individual session plan? It's been a while since I asked you on this topic.
Yeah. Well, if there's promotion relegation, I'm going to tell you over and over again until we all get it sunk in our heads. That is a synonym for saying there's a meritocracy. And if there's a meritocracy, the best coaches are going to rise. The worst coaches are going to fall over the course of time. And so every coach is incentivized to become the best coach they can possibly be. And you are going to figure it out. The likelihood that you are going to figure out the right things to do goes up. That's all. And so when it comes to session planning, or what kind of session or what kind of activities and how you should mix it up and all that sort of stuff, there's a higher probability that more coaches are going to converge to the right things instead of the wrong things when they know that it is a meritocracy.
Yeah. Dude, I saw a kind of an outrageous comment on Twitter the other day. It was like, oh, you know, the U.S. still has time to be successful in the 2026 World Cup. If we implement promotion relegation now into MLS, we're going to go far in the tournament. But I don't think people realize how far or how long it's going to take the machine of promotion relegation to actually start rising the top performers and the whole machine to start actually working. You know, it's not just an overnight thing where all of a sudden the MLS implements it and now we're a top competing nation in the world. It's going to take 5, 10, 15 years, bro. You know, so the sooner the better, bro. Hopefully it's soon.
Yeah. I have to correct what you said, and that is MLS is not the one who implements promotion relegation. It's the governing body, the regulatory body, the federation is the one who instantiates promotion relegation throughout the ecosystem. It is not a league that does promotion relegation. No, no, no. It's the entire ecosystem. So it's not MLS. Sorry to be that guy, but the audience needs to understand this, because the way we frame and the way we frame topics and the way we talk about topics, then, you know, guides what happens after. I'm right. Not expressing myself properly. So we have to frame things correctly. And yeah, man, it takes a bit of time to filter for the meritocracy to work. You don't get North Korea and, you know, topple the dictatorship and put in, okay, it's going to be an open market, democratic state from this point forward. It's not going to be like, oh, next year, boom, look, they're creating some of the best AI companies in the world. And boom, look, they've got self-driving cars. And boom, look, you've got rocket ships going to Mars. No, guys, it'll take a while, but yeah, you have to start right away, Ben. And the results take time, Ben. But the attitude and the incentives of all the participants happens immediately. So if tomorrow America magically, right, said, okay, we have an open pyramid. It's promotion relegation. It's an open market. You can start a club at any, you know, at the lowest tier of the pyramid, and you can work your way up. And if you suck at the top tier, you're going to be working your way down. The very next day, everybody in the ecosystem changes their mindset and starts working differently. So that does change immediately, Ben.
Right. Well, Gary, okay, so you said MLS doesn't implement it, right? But you also say that MLS controls everything. MLS controls yes. U.S. soccer and the federation. So wouldn't it in fact be them that is saying, yes, we do want this, or no, we do not want it?
Well, that's presuming that. So, okay. Let's unravel this. So MLS controls the federation at the moment. It's not supposed to. It's like saying that, I don't know. It's like saying, let's say we're talking about, let's talk about computing or personal computers and phones. It's analogous to saying that Apple controls the United States government, right? And if Apple controlled the United States government, Apple wouldn't have any competitors in their space, really. They would, the only computer that you would get would be an Apple computer, Benny. But we don't have that necessarily, right? We have an open market. There's Apple, and then there's obviously Windows-based machines and maybe some other laggards out there. So MLS effectively controls the federation. The federation is the regulator of the ecosystem. If we're going to have promotion relegation, as things are now, yes, MLS would have to give the green light for us to have promotion relegation. I understand your point. But that, in my opinion, is not going to happen. So the way that we get promotion relegation is with the federation gaining its independence, one modality, one possibility, and them just saying, fuck you, MLS, we're going to do this anyway. Okay. So how that happens, that's a whole other episode, a whole other multiple episodes. There's all kinds of things that we can consider, legal cases or legal situations. We could have maybe CONCACAF coming into the picture. We could have the big boy FIFA coming into the picture. We could have your boy, the 47th president of the United States saying, hey, why don't we have a open ecosystem in America? Like, yeah, we're going to do that. I'm going to sign an executive order. Fuck you, MLS. You don't get Division One monopoly over everything. So that is a true open ecosystem, Benny. If MLS gives the thumbs up, it would be under the pretense that MLS will continue controlling all the tiers.
Right.
And so that wouldn't be an open ecosystem. I'll give you an example. Let's say that USL continues to grow and they do implement their own quote unquote version of ProRel, which is not an open ecosystem, but they continue getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and MLS feels a little threatened or wants to capture the entire market, the second division, third division, fourth division, whatever, they might buy out USL. And then all of a sudden MLS is in control of all the pro tiers. And then they'll have quote unquote promotion relegation, but it's not, right? It's just internal promotion relegation. It's not an open ecosystem. One company still controls all of the teams and all of the player contracts and all the whole enchilada.
Yeah. I think step one, you need to get Don Garber off the board of U.S. soccer, bro. That's nepotism, whole other episode.
It's ridiculous that the guy has been on the board of the governing body. First off, kind of period, because that's a conflict of interest.
Right.
Like you're obviously going to be voting on everything for the interest of MLS and nothing else. If it benefits somebody else at the detriment of MLS, the guy is not going to vote for that. Okay, so it's already a conflict of interest. It should be an independent board. Yeah, but the guy's been there, I don't know, 18 years on the board. It's insane. 20 years, I have no idea.
Yeah, but not only voting for MLS, but also influencing other board members and high-level people up there quid pro pro in exchange for, hey, I'm going to give you this team, or you know what I mean? Like
100%.
That guy has so much influence.
They're all stooges. They're all stooges of MLS. Like you don't even have to influence the other board members because the other board members are already puppets of Major League Soccer.
Yeah. All right, bro. A whole other episode right there, dude.
Indeed.
Hey,
indeed.
Dude, Trump signing an executive order to make soccer called football in this country.
I saw that headline. Is that a joke or is that a serious thing?
No, I think somebody asked him that and I think he just responded. He's like, "Dad, I think we can do that."
How about
Trump celebrating with Chelsea, bro? Legendary.
That's pretty funny.
That was wild, bro.
It's pretty funny. It's hilarious, man.
Yeah.
And I don't know why some people got up in arms about it, because, you know, this is always brought up every season where after the Super Bowl, the owner of the NFL team that just won it is up there with the trophy and like all that stuff. And some people have a cow, but it's kind of like American sports culture, right? The owner goes in there and does this sort of stuff. And yes, Trump doesn't own Chelsea Football Club, but he's kind of like, you know, there's a parallel there. Like, hey, I'm going to go there and celebrate with the players and the trophy. And it's part of my trophy. Like, I hosted this whole fucking tournament. You should be thanking me.
No, dude, apparently, I don't know if this is true or not, but they say that he kept the real trophy of the Club World Cup in his office, and he made FIFA give Chelsea like a duplicate of it or something. He's like, nah, I'm keeping this. I swear, bro. Look it up. Dude. Watch when the next year in the World Cup final, whoever wins, he'll be up there too, bro.
Yeah, hilarious, man. we're living in a simulation, Benny.
Yep. Crazy. All right, bro. This is a good episode, dude. I think a lot of coaches have missed our coaching chats, so this will be good for them.
Okay, good. All right, let's sign off right here then. Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches, you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.